For this and all Clinical Updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Today in the clinical podcast, we have Zaida Zederlief, who's a physician assistant in weight management in CenterCare. Hello, Zaida. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And today you are going to be talking to us about something that, to be honest, I never heard about before, which is ARFID, Avoidance Restrictive Food Intake Disorder.
Yeah, exactly.
Did I get that right?
You did, ARFID.
ARFID, right.
Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. Mm-hmm.
So let's start from the beginning. What is ARDIF? ARFID.
ARFID, yeah, I got you. I'm coming to you today actually in my eating disorder umbrella. So I work in both departments, weight management and eating disorders. And so this ARFID is prevalent for our eating disorder population we see. So what is ARFID? The formal DSM-5 diagnosis is a feeding or eating disturbance based on sensory characteristics of food, concern about adverse consequences of food, resulting in some kind of medical complication and some kind of psychosocial functioning impact. And ultimately, it can't be explained better by cultural, religious practices, food insecurities, cannot also be prevalent or present with anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder. So they have no weight or body image related concerns. And then it can't be attributable to some other psychiatric illness.
So it's in its own niche.
It's in its own niche. I like to describe it as kind of like the black sheep of the eating disorder world.
Okay.
The history of the diagnosis is it was previously generally referred to as like a feeding disorder. So in the DSM-5, it was separated off and put under the eating disorder category. That was actually only done in 2013. So it's a fairly new diagnosis in the grand scheme of the DSM-5.
So, you know, I'm always, when we have these new diagnoses, especially with things like around eating, for example, I wonder if we underdiagnose or overdiagnose, and especially that's relevant since you mentioned cultural practices, social. So, you know, if you go to many places and they see the amount we eat here, they would feel like we are nuts and vice versa. So are we over or under diagnosing to begin with?
I think right now the biggest thing we see a problem with is people are not considering the exclusionary criteria. So the ones that are, like you said, cannot be religious, cannot be food insecurity, cannot be anorexia, and cannot be due to some other kind of psychiatric illness. Cool. And those are big ones that we see. It just kind of gets slapped on there without considering those exclusion data or exclusion criteria. So I think right now, yes, it probably is being misused and misdiagnosed in kind of just like as a placeholder. I see a lot of those referrals come in as like ARFID, but really they have some other diagnosis. But that's a complex diagnosis. I don't expect anybody other than people that working in eating disorders to really be able to sort through those things. Because one of the things I wanted to highlight with ARFID, which is that it does kind of have its roots in a pediatric feeding disorder or just a feeding disorder. And that kind of branches from a range of picky eaters, problem feeders, and ARFID.
Okay.
And a picky eater is a common thing. A third to a half of kids with picky eating grow out of that, right? So they might just get older and try different foods because social pressures and they are fine. Problem eaters are going to have a little bit more struggles with food. They're a little bit more disruptive at mealtimes. Their food lists are getting smaller. They have less and less safe foods. Ultimately, they last a little bit longer. And then if it continues to that degree, oftentimes undiagnosed problems with feeding in pediatric populations can then turn into ARFID when they're older. And that's kind of based on one of the primarily three subsets of ARFID.
Yeah. So before we get into that, I had a couple of questions. So I read that it's commonly linked to other psychiatric comorbidities. So for example, if you had somebody with depression, how you tell apart that they don't have anorexia from the depression versus ARFID?
It's incredibly challenging. I find that the majority of patients, and actually that does kind of bring me to the three subsets, subtypes, and then I can answer that question after explaining the three subtypes of it, I think.
Sure.
So the easy ones that are pretty, I think people would think of that and go, yeah, that makes sense that they might struggle. The most common that we see probably that especially related to the pediatric feeding disorders is the aversive subtype of ARFID. That aversive subtype is rooted in sensory processing disorder. I don't like the texture. I can't smell it, stand the smell. I think it looks weird and therefore I won't eat it.
But this has to be towards all foods.
Certain foods, so certain textures, certain foods, certain combinations of things. If it has, meat in it, I won't eat it because I don't like the ground beef texture. Or if it has weird color in it, then I don't want to eat that, right? Or
Okay.
the texture of cottage cheese or the texture of certain meats.
And this one is what subtype?
Aversive.
Aversive.
Yep.
So why is it abnormal? When do you cross that line?
Exactly. When it starts really impacting their abilities to eat. So we see kids that, they can't eat at school because they don't have any options, or they go to friends' houses and their parents have to pack them meals because they can't eat anything other than the very specific type of chicken nuggets. And if the company dares to change their formulation, it's a really big deal. And those kids most often are autistic. It's a really big overlap is autism. And so
That was a question, yeah.
yeah, so that brings in the aversive subtype with autism and how that really is presenting there. And those kids have sensory processing disorders oftentimes in other ways, whether it's auditory overstimulation, whether it's tactile from clothing, things like that. It leaches then into their food in that experience. And sometimes it impacts their growth. Sometimes it impacts their functioning. And that's kind of when it becomes to be more of a problem.
So how is that? That's its second subtype.
That's aversive is still that first subtype. So
Aversive in
yep, and then the
autism.
second subtype is avoidant. And avoidant is typically this is a patient or a child or an adult that is growing normally, living normally, and they have some kind of traumatic event with food, choking, vomiting, anaphylaxis. They're generally just getting really bad stomach aches every time they eat, or they've had a weird experience with food or something of the other. And now they're terrified to eat because I might choke on it. Right? I don't want to eat that because I might choke. And then they can avoid actually eating like enough food in general to the point where they're again malnourished, underweight, medical complexities, whatever that may be, losing weight, not growing appropriately. So the avoidant is kind of straightforward. They've had some kind of traumatic event, typically with food, impacting their growth. We're going to see the most common comorbid condition there is going to be anxiety. They've got anxiety, maybe some panic, and that's just going to contribute to that fear cycle they have with the food. That was pretty straightforward. The most kind of nebulous one is the restrictive subtype of ARFID. And that one really is this kind of all-encompassing, and we see the most variety with that subtype. So one is depression. So we see anhedonia. I don't want to take care of myself. I can't take care of myself. I can't get out of bed. I can't brush my hair. I can't brush my teeth. Therefore, I'm also not eating enough. And that can contribute to significant weight loss.
So see, how is that not different than somebody with anhedonia from depression?
I want to highlight each of these examples, and then I want to tell you kind of the
Oh, sure.
overarching, what is the physiology then that contributes to the rut that they get in. So we have that example, right? Because
Okay.
you would think then, I agree with you in the DSM-5, you can explain that by some other condition. So it can't be ARFID because it's depression related, right? When I was first learning this, that was my argument too. It was like, no way, this can't be a diagnosis because they have depression and that's the problem. We need to treat that. But I'll explain a little bit why it doesn't seem to be that easy. We then see anxiety. I'm so overly anxious. I literally have no appetite. So I'm anxious, anxious, anxious. I can't eat. I'm losing weight. ADHD. I have ADHD. I can't focus. I'm not able to interrupt my day because I don't really care that much about eating. It's not rewarding. I want to do this, that, or the other. Substance use disorder, vaping. I cannot tell you how many of these kids I see, these adolescents and early 20s that are vaping. They don't even know it, but two, three packs of cigarettes a day in their vape. Significant appetite suppression, olfactory nerve disruption, gastritis, you name it. Substance use is getting in the way. But what happens in all of these cases is that they're generally losing weight, really low weighted. I mean, we're seeing BMIs 15, 14. They're.
So losing weight is the line to cross to be in ARFID.
It could be, but generally, yes, we do see that weight loss is happening and that there might.
Otherwise, it could be a picky eater or
Yeah,
just.
exactly. We do sometimes see like electrolyte abnormalities, low heart rates, and things that coincide with that. But generally speaking, yeah,
Sure.
they're really low weighted. And when you get that low weighted, we start experiencing hypometabolism, right? Our body is slowing down. We're constipated. We have decreased gastric emptying. We're fatigued. We can't concentrate. We're cold. We feel miserable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to get out of that rut of I'm feeling physically horrible because I'm underweight, I also am so anxious because my brain's in fight or flight mode, or I'm so depressed because I don't have enough energy for my brain to function, or whatever it may be, that is actually where the eating disorder care is needed. Because mental health, general mental health supports don't understand that complexity of how do we get weight restoration up to speed? What is related to eating issues? What is related to depression? We, at that point, when I'm seeing a patient in that state, it's chicken or the egg. Are they depressed and anxious because they've lost all this weight? Or mm-hmm. are they depressed and anxious at baseline and that's what was the catalyst? And so weight restoration, monitoring for hypermetabolism and refeeding and all those kinds of variables. And then hopefully, maybe even simultaneously, treating those comorbid conditions, getting them to a place where they're able to kind of function and eat better and get out of that rut. So that's kind of why the eating disorder piece is needed, despite them being other conditions.
Now, to get to the pathophysiology of it, just to, you know, because I understand a kid will, and it sounds like the majority of these are kids, right? Or it starts in childhood. It's rarer to happen in adulthood, right?
I wouldn't say rare. I would say the majority of the aversive types are childhood.
Okay.
And then a choking or a traumatic event with food can happen at any time in somebody's life, and that could happen at any point.
Sure.
And then same with the depression, anxiety, ADHD, things like that. I would say ADHD generally is younger, but depression, anxiety, vaping is all ages. But yeah, usually they're 20s is the most common lately, at least. I've seen a lot of 20-year-olds.
So let me ask you about, and this is kind of an uneducated guess about this, okay?
Okay.
So do you think that this could be in part related to a social construct that we generate? So another way to ask is, do you think this happens in while there is civil war in Rwanda or displacement in, you know, in Syria? Because I understand then your question will be like, why do they lose weight? And that's when you create this self-fulfilling prophecy, right? They get into this and then they lose weight and they get used and the hypometabolism probably decreases appetite, etc. But I always struggle with this kind of diagnosis that before it was like, if you don't want food, you go to bed, there's no food, period. There's no such thing as PTE. How did this come to be? Did we miss it before? What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are that we live in a culture that weight loss is good and weight gain is bad.
Okay.
And so these patients that are losing weight, it might be missed for a long time as like, oh, it's fine. She's losing weight. No big deal.
Mm.
Because in other cultures, like the ones you're thinking of, generally, weight loss would not be a good thing, right?
No.
We'd be really worried.
Yeah.
And that cultural difference, I think, is probably the big underlying issue that we see, that these patients may have been missed one place or another, or we're just not as worried, oh, they'll be fine, because we live in such a nutrient-dense culture. And we have that dichotomy of weight loss is good, weight gain is bad, which is obviously just not the case ever. That can't be a generalization we subscribe to in either weight management or eating disorders.
Sure.
But I think if I were to make it really simple, that's probably where we don't see this in other cultures as much.
So in a way, it really borders with, I know it's not the same, but it borders with body dysmorphia, anxiety, depression. It's kind of like, in my mind, it's like snagging in between all those diagnoses, like a standalone thing. And it's at the end of the day, it seems over and over, it's hard to make that diagnosis and not anorexia secondary too. Is that fair to say?
The biggest differentiator is anorexia nervosa is a drive for weight loss. They want to lose weight. They are dissatisfied with their body. And their goal for eating less is because they want to keep losing weight. They're also terrified of weight gain is anorexia nervosa. ARFID patients desperately want to gain weight. They desperately want to be able to eat better and feel better. And they know they're not feeling well because they can't eat, but they can't eat for XYZ reason. So that's a really clear divider of anorexia and ARFID. However, I don't know if we have enough time to go into that like further, but we do see that overlap of anorexia nervosa, and just the literal medical word of anorexia, the lack of eating, does have overlaps with anorexia nervosa. But any human being that experiences lack of eating or anorexia can experience symptoms of anorexia nervosa. So we do sometimes see patients develop And I could go into the Minnesota starvation experiment and why we see that. And if we had time, I would. But those are all kinds of those things that we saw, that when people lose weight for whatever reason, they develop odd behaviors around food. And again, that's an eating disorder etiology type phenomenon that I believe with what we see in our practice, it is needed to treat them within an eating disorder umbrella.
Okay.
When it gets to that degree is my main thing.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to have to leave treatment out.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, and I hope you put this in the slides that are attached. When should people refer patients onward, and to who? What kind of service? What person? How does that work?
For kids and adolescents, if they're still on their growth chart, which will go to age 20, anytime a kid crosses over a growth curve, a single growth curve, it's a referral. That's my recommendation. At any point where height or weight is faltering, we need to see a referral because they're not growing appropriately. Okay.
And this is in the context of suspecting ARFID, not in general.
Yeah. Honestly, in general, if a kid is losing weight for some reason, we should be evaluating it further. Maybe it's just they have celiac disease, right? But it could just be that they have an eating disorder. So any growth faltering past one growth chart line is definitely concerning that something's going on. They're not growing right. And in adults, generally speaking, unexplained weight loss is a good reason to refer. And right now in our local area, referring to eating disorder program, St. Cloud Centric Care Eating Disorder Outpatient Program, that's an ambulatory consult eating disorders in the EPIC. And we do see as young as 7 for kids right now. And there's discussion about seeing younger. But some of these kids may have pediatric feeding disorders that early primary prevention care can prevent that from turning into ARFID as adults. So those are kind of some of the things. Yeah. Unexplained weight loss for adults, greater than 10% body weight reduction for adults is generally where we really start to see concern. And then same with kids, or seeing anybody on growth charts that are shifting over one growth curve is where we start to say, let's refer, get some more evaluation, get some specialized care.
And you don't have satellite clinics in other center care sites?
No, not right now. Nope.
Do you do video or e-consults?
We do. We always ask the consult, the medical, you start with a medical consult. So starting with the medical provider, it's a visit, EKG, and labs. We do ask those visits are in person, but then from then on out, we do offer video visits. So you bet we see patients from Alexandria, from you name it, all over the place. People are driving quite a ways sometimes to come see us. We're kind of, I like to describe our eating disorder program as kind of the funnel of central Minnesota, because we capture a lot of northern Minnesota eating disorders, funneling them where they need to go, potentially down to the cities if they need higher levels of care.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, I love it. It's good. I appreciate having the space for the eating disorder side of my care. I'm passionate about that too.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
Sarah.